Let's start this session with our final meditation for this retreat. So make yourself nice and comfortable. So as always, we begin by preparing the body, setting it into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. Allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness. And imagine the inner purity of your mind, your Buddha nature. Imagine this deepest dimension of your mind, in the form of a small, white, radiant sphere of light in the center of your chest, at the level of your heart. And then bring to mind someone who you know well, who's currently experiencing some sort of physical or mental problem or suffering. And picture them very clearly in front of you. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they were free of that problem, free of that suffering. May you be free of all suffering and its causes. And then imagine their problem or suffering in the form of black smoke filling their body. And then with each in-breath, imagine drawing that black smoke out of their body and bringing it into the sphere of light at your heart, completely dissolving it there. So with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their suffering at your heart. And then imagine the black cloud is now completely extinguished. And now they're completely free of that problem or suffering. Take joy in this. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they had happiness and its causes. May you be truly well and happy. And then with each out-breath, imagine immeasurable rays of light radiating out from your heart, filling and saturating their entire body and mind, and transforming into everything they need to be happy. So with each out-breath, breathe out the light of loving kindness, sending them whatever they need to be happy. And then imagine that they've now found the genuine happiness that is their heart's desire. And take delight in this. And then allow your field of loving kindness and compassion to expand out further. And allow your mind to move around. And whoever comes to mind, whether it's a friend, someone you don't know very well, or perhaps even someone who you find a little bit difficult, bring them to mind. Attend to them. And picture them very clearly in front of you. They are just like yourself in wanting to be happy and wanting to be free of suffering. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they are free of suffering and its causes. May you be free of all suffering and its causes. And may you be truly well and happy. And then with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their suffering at your heart. And with each out-breath, breathe out the light of loving kindness, sending them whatever they need to be happy. And then allow your mind to continue to move around. And whoever comes to mind, attend to them. Breathing in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their suffering at your heart, and breathing out the light of loving kindness, sending them whatever they need to be happy. No matter how much darkness is drawn in, it is all extinguished without a trace. And no matter how much light is sent out, it is sent out from an inexhaustible source that is in no way depleted. So allow your mind to continue to move around. Whoever comes to mind, whether it's an individual or even a group of people, breathe in with compassion, breathing out the light of loving kindness. And then in conclusion, we can dedicate the positive potential from not only this meditation, but from this entire retreat, towards the goal of cultivating mindfulness and emotional balance. In particular, towards the goal of cultivating a calm, clear and focused mind. Towards becoming the masters of our mind, healing the mind. And towards the goal of cultivating loving kindness and compassion towards all living beings. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. So let's now have a little bit of a review of the things that we've sort of covered in the last days. So again, we've been mainly looking at cultivating mindfulness and emotional balance. But what we're really overall looking at is really just mental balance. And if we want to benefit from our mindfulness training and emotional balance training, we need very much an integrated approach. So here, of course, we can talk about these four different types of balance. Each one of them, of course, is very important. And if we can work with each of those four types of mental balance, then we're really going to maximize the benefit that we will receive in our daily life. The first of those was this motivational balance, which is developing healthy aspirations and desires. Aspirations and desires towards our own and others' happiness. If we don't have this, then the rest of this training really becomes problematical, if not impossible.
For example, if we have very unhealthy aspirations and desires, if we have this motivational imbalance in terms of things like simply craving for money and pleasure and praise and so forth, if that is our aspiration and desires in life, then we're going to have a lot of problems in developing any sort of attentional balance, cognitive balance or emotional balance. Through engaging in this sort of aspirations, we are going to simply be caught up in attachment and aversion, caught up in the hope-fear cycle, hoping for pleasant things, fearing and worrying about unpleasant things. And so even though our aspiration is for happiness, because it's unhealthy aspiration, in fact, we won't be moving towards happiness, we'll be moving away from happiness and towards suffering. And this was very much highlighted in that earlier quote I gave from that great Indian master, Shantideva, who said, "Those seeking to escape from suffering hasten right toward their own misery. And with the very desire for happiness, out of delusion, they destroy their own well-being as if it were the enemy." So here, of course, if we have our aspirations is about what we can get from the world, then we're really in trouble. A more healthy aspiration, of course, in terms of striving for our own and others' happiness, is actually what we can give to the world. So if we can really improve that aspiration and not simply have an aspiration of craving for these sorts of things like money and pleasure and wealth and praise and so forth, but rather have an aspiration of contributing something to the world, of developing our inner qualities, then that is a very healthy aspiration, and that's going to be a very good basis for really overall mental balance and developing attentional, cognitive and emotional balance. So that aspiration is towards what's called more genuine happiness rather than this temporal pleasure. And that genuine happiness is a state of inner well-being and inner happiness where we are in sync, in harmony with reality. And it's all more about what we can contribute and give to the world rather than what we can get from the world. So if we can sort out our motivational balance, if we can develop these healthy aspirations and desires, this is a very good basis for the other three areas of mental balance. The second, of course, is attentional balance. Here, this was what we looked at here in this retreat as our mindfulness training, is that, as it's mentioned here, developing our attention skills, our ability to cultivate a calm, clear, focused mind, our ability to see clearly. So, of course, in that training, the imbalance that we're trying to overcome is dullness and distraction. So that's our current mode of operating, is that we don't have very good attentional balance now. We're caught up in a lot of dullness and distraction. And actually getting caught up in a lot of dullness and distraction predisposes us to a lot of emotional imbalance. It's much more easy when we're caught up in dullness and distraction to get caught up in all sorts of mental afflictions. So if we can put effort into the attentional balance training, the mindfulness training, to overcome dullness and distraction and develop a very calm, clear, focused mind, of course that in itself will bring us enormous benefit. Our mind will be much more clear, of course, much more peaceful, will be much more effective in everything we do in our life, much less stress and so forth. But also, of course, attentional balance is the basis for both cognitive and emotional balance. Because if we are able to see clearly, then we can really see clearly objectively, meaning we can see reality much more clearly as it is. So if we don't have this cognitive balance, if we can't see reality clearly, if we have the imbalance of ignorance, and here ignorance is misunderstanding reality, then that's going to bring a lot of emotional imbalance. And we saw that earlier, that here, if we have this ignorance, if we misunderstand reality, And we looked at that in sort of two very brief ways. One is that, of course, we grasp onto things as stable and static when we know intellectually that they're changing moment by moment. That causes a lot of attachments and aversions. Also, of course, we grasp onto things as existing independently. There seems to be an independent me here and an independent objective world out there. So we're grasping onto this subject-object duality, this dualistic view that the world is made up of many separate, discrete, independent things. But again, intellectually, we can actually appreciate that everything is interdependent. Everything depends on other factors. So again, if we don't develop that cognitive balance, if we simply see things as existing independently, then we end up with a lot of attachment and aversion, a lot of mental, emotional imbalance, a lot of mental affliction. So if we can develop work on this cognitive balance, then that is a very good basis for emotional balance. Because now we don't have very good emotional balance, we end up with a lot of imbalance, meaning that when we are faced with certain stimulus, we simply react out of habit. And our reactions are based on our false view of reality, of our false view of how we see these stimulus. And because of that, we react to pleasant stimulus with craving and attachment, because we believe that seems to be the source of our happiness, and we react to unpleasant stimulus with aversion, hostility, anger and hatred, because it seems like that is the source of our suffering. So therefore we end up with a lot of emotional imbalance through attachment, aversion, jealousy, craving, greed, fear, anxiety. All of these things are what's coming from that cognitive imbalance, and we end up with all that emotional imbalance. So therefore, on the basis of having cognitive balance, then we can start to cultivate emotional balance, meaning not to be stimulus reaction machines. But of course, to begin to do that as well, we need the attentional balance. Because if we don't have mindfulness, then we're not going to be able to be aware of these stimulus, and then instead of reacting out of our bad habits, to respond in a better way. So the attentional balance is both the basis of cognitive and emotional balance. And so then in emotional balance, instead of reacting in this imbalanced way with attachment and aversion, then we can respond in a balanced, healthy way. And so instead of attachment and aversion, we can respond to things, situations, through loving kindness and compassion, empathetic joy and equanimity. And so we saw there that these are some of the core elements of this emotional balance. So each one is the basis of the next, but of course also each one reinforces an earlier one. Because if we can have cognitive balance, if we can see things, reality clearly, that will help us to really improve our motivation in terms of what is really happiness and how to achieve that. And of course, the more emotional balance we have, that will act as a good basis for improving our attentional balance. So each one reinforces the rest. But in general, this is the order in which they can really start to build as a platform for the next part of balance. So if we really want to maximize our benefit in our life, if we can focus on all of these four areas in an integrated way, then that would be best. Again, I mentioned earlier that mindfulness now is very popular in the modern society. So this is becoming popular, but unfortunately, these other elements don't seem to be very much addressed. So people are trying to develop attentional balance here, but they still have very unhealthy aspirations. They're still aspiring and craving for all these sorts of things. And so so then they wonder why their mindfulness training is not really doing much. It's pacifying them a little bit, but as long as they have this motivational, cognitive and emotional imbalances, then that attention training is not really going to bring us very much at all.
So, just to summarise then, the two core elements that we focused on in this retreat, of course, we focus mainly on the attentional balance and the emotional balance. So just to summarise some of those core elements of what we did in this retreat. So first off, the attentional balance or the mindfulness training. We saw there that, of course, the goal of mindfulness training is to develop a calm, clear, focused mind. To develop these three qualities of relaxation, stability, a stable mind, to be able to focus without becoming distracted, and a clear mind or clarity. So these are the core qualities we are cultivating in our mindfulness training, our attention training, is a relaxed mind, a stable mind, and a clear mind. And of course, the two main tools we use in that mindfulness training is mindfulness. So remember, mindfulness here, smriti or sati in Pali, is our ability to remember. Mindfulness is defined simply as our ability to hold the object without becoming distracted. So we use that tool of mindfulness. We're trying to strengthen our mindfulness so that we can better and better focus on the object in a more stable and a more clear way. But of course, we need a way of monitoring that. So the second tool is this tool of introspection, quality control, monitoring the mindfulness, noticing if we are going into the imbalances of dullness or distraction, and if so, to fix that, adjust that, reapply the mindfulness. So these were the two main tools we're using in this attention training, the mindfulness training. And then, of course, we looked at what sorts of objects we can use for this training. And so again, the general recommendation for that training is to use the object that is most suitable for you, that works best for you. In this retreat, we focused on two particular objects. The first was the breath, which is probably the most widely emphasised object in this training. And within the breath practice, we saw we practiced three variations of that breath practice. The full body practice, which is very helpful for working with relaxation. Also, that is very good as an evening practice, as we practice, as a transition into sleep. Then we looked at the abdomen practice, focusing on the area of the abdomen. Fairly large area, quite easy to focus on, quite good for helping develop more attentional stability. And then the nostrils practice, much more subtle, small object, therefore very helpful improving the clarity of our attention. So these were the three variations of the breath practice that we looked at. And then yesterday we looked at the mind practice, focusing on the mind itself. So probably many of you found that much more challenging than the breath practice. Some of you may have found it more suitable than the breath practice because it's usually more challenging because it's not a tangible physical object. It's a much more subtle object. But again, with this practice, enormous benefits, particularly in our modern society where we really often are tormented by our mind, we're often the slaves of our mind. In this practice, not only are we cultivating the mindfulness and developing a calm, clear, focused mind, we are also, in this practice then, becoming the masters of our mind instead of the slaves of our mind. So I think particularly for many of us in our modern society, this would be an excellent mindfulness practice to cultivate. So those were the two objects we focused on in this retreat. Of course, there are many other suitable objects for mindfulness training, but I think for many of us, particularly in our modern society, probably one of those two objects might be the best object to use for mindfulness training. And then, of course, when we looked at the emotional balance training, there we began to look at how we have imbalance. And so there we looked at these three poisons. The three poisons of ignorance, attachment and aversion. And aversion in particular in the form of anger.
And so we saw there that this ignorance, this fundamental ignorance, is actually a cognitive imbalance. It's a misunderstanding of reality. And from a Buddhist perspective, this is the underlying source of all of our suffering. And so, therefore, if we can work at this level, we can improve our cognitive balance. In particular here, internalizing the intellectual understanding which we already have. So even though intellectually we may have fairly good cognitive balance in intellectually understanding reality, unfortunately, it's not our intellectual understanding that is driving our behavior. It's our instinctive habit. And our instinctive habit is opposite to our intellectual understanding. Our instinctive habit in our behavior is that things are actually quite stable. They're not really changing much. Instinctively, we see them as quite stable. And instinctively, we see things as existing completely independently. So if we can internalize our intellectual understanding of things like impermanence and interdependency, if we can internalize that and then start to experientially have more cognitive balance, we'll start to overcome this ignorance, which acts as a basis for the attachments, aversion and anger and so forth. And so then we have a look at, in this retreat, at particularly attachment and anger. And we looked and we defined very clearly what they were, how they really create us a lot of suffering, and we looked at some methods for dealing with attachment, anger, and also we had a look at this other mental affliction of self-cherishing, this selfish attitude. And so with each of these imbalances, these mental afflictions, we can deal with them from a number of perspectives that we had a brief look at in this retreat. One, of course, is simply through our attentional training, and this is why focusing on the mind is so helpful, is simply when we notice some attachment, aversion, anger, jealousy arising in our mind, one way of dealing with it, of course, is simply not allow ourselves to get caught up in it. Is simply observe it as it arises and passes, arises and passes. So therefore, our attention training, our mindfulness training, particularly using the mind, is very helpful as a basis for developing more emotional balance and not getting caught up in these mental afflictions. But of course, we can also work with these mental afflictions in a number of other ways in terms of a more direct antidote. For example, we looked at anger. One antidote is simply patience. And also, we can then use our wisdom, our cognitive balance, also as a way of dealing with attachment, aversion and anger. You know, to investigate the object of anger, the agent of anger and anger itself through the wisdom practice to dissolve the anger. Because that wisdom, if we can overcome the ignorance, there's no basis for anger to arise. And then, of course, also here in this retreat, we looked at the compassion aspect of the practice to work with emotional balance and overcoming the imbalance. So here, of course, we focus primarily on what's called these four immeasurables, these four qualities that we're trying to cultivate towards all living beings. The first of those, of course, was loving kindness, then compassion, empathetic joy and equanimity. So loving kindness, of course, was the wish for ourselves and others to be happy, compassion, the wish for ourselves and others to be free of suffering. And then empathetic joy is a rejoicing in our own and others' virtues. This one particularly important also in our modern society because we have so much focus on the negative. And we saw that not only do we have a focus on the negative in our modern society, we engage a lot in this cognitive fusion. So cognitive fusion, of course, is also another example of cognitive imbalance, a false perspective. Because cognitive fusion is an invalid perspective. So if we are identifying ourselves or others with our thoughts, emotions, behaviours, habits and so forth, then that is a basis for a lot of emotional imbalance. And we saw that in this retreat, that if we do identify particularly others, particularly with their negative aspects, their negative thoughts, emotions and behaviours and habits, then we end up with a lot of anger and hatred and hostility. And similarly, if we do the same with ourselves, we end up a lot of hostility, hatred toward ourselves, low self-esteem and self-hatred. So therefore, we need to make sure that we don't engage in this cognitive fusion and have a correct perspective, have more cognitive balance in terms of simply correctly seeing there is a person engaging in this particular behaviour, or simply acknowledging I have engaged in this certain behaviour. So to distinguish the agent from the action. Of course, we're not talking about separating. We're just talking about distinguishing these two aspects of experience. They're not identical. They're not the same thing. So that can also be very much helpful in developing emotional balance. And so empathetic joy, and then equanimity, of course, is to develop this equal attitude towards everyone, a sense of closeness to everyone. And we also saw in those four immeasurables this idea of the near enemy, that each one of them has something that it's easy to slide into without knowing it, and it seems like it's the same thing, but it actually pollutes and creates problems. So, of course, with loving kindness, it's attachment. So it's very easy to slide into attachment, and each one of the other four immeasurables can be helpful to avoid that. So if we see our loving kindness sliding into attachment, of course, then we can focus on cultivating equanimity to overcome that. Equanimity itself, of course, can slide into indifference, to be equally indifferent from others. If we find ourselves, our equanimity sliding into simply indifference, we can work on compassion to see how ourselves and others are suffering so that we can't really develop that indifference to others. We can develop a lot of empathy and compassion for ourselves and others. And then, of course, compassion sometimes can slide into this sort of hopeless, despairing state of mind. Therefore, to overcome that, focus on the positive aspects through empathetic joy. And then empathetic joy can also become more frivolous and not really rejoicing in anything of value, but rejoicing in meaningless things and sometimes even rejoicing in harmful things. So if that rejoicing degenerates like that, then we can reflect back on loving kindness and reflect on this wish for genuine happiness. So this is some of the things we looked at within the emotional balance training. And so that's about all I wanted to summarise in terms of these two parts that we practiced in this retreat. Does anyone have any questions regarding either of those? And then I'll move on to the next topic. Yes.
There is, yesterday we talked about fear, because if there is nothing to grasp onto, you feel
you're going out of existence.
You're losing control.
Sure.
And the ego wants to pick you
down.
So that produces fear, leading to a sense of possibly surrender. Go with it. Don't fall into the world. Don't try and bring the ego in to grasp.
So when we say being masters of our mind, we're not,
This is the delicate topic of, in terms of looking at what is existing and how is it existing. That whenever we talk at a more sort of conventional level, of course there is a me, there is a mind that we're trying to become the master of and so forth. For us, of course, when we talk at this conventional level, using those terms, we grasp onto all of those terms and then substantiate the ego or substantiate a self or whatever. Then, of course, when we talk about looking at how do all of these things exist, then they simply dissolve this solid ego, solid self and solid mind and solid body. But that doesn't mean there's no me and no mind. And that's what the difficulty in this whole thing is, that for us there seems to be just two possibilities. Either there is this ego and self and so forth, or there's no ego and no self and no nothing. So we don't see a third possibility. So that's why whenever we use this sort of conventional language, we just grasp onto that. And then when we use language where we say there's none of that, we flip to the other extreme of nihilism, nothing really exists. So what we need to come to appreciate is that there's a middle way between these two extremes. And the middle way is that there is conventionally a person who is trying to become the master of their mind. But the question is, how is that person existing and how is the mind existing? And it's not existing as just some solid, stable, independent thing. So that's the balance that we're trying to achieve, particularly in this cognitive training. And it's a very tricky balance, and it's not so easy to find that middle way. We tend to flip from one extreme to the other quite constantly. So, therefore, if we have this sort of, you mentioned this egoless experience, we are to not interpret that, meaning there's no person, nothing really exists. What it means is that there is no independent me, no self, no solid me. That's all that we are coming to. So it's very tricky to hold that middle ground, because we are not familiar with it. We are only familiar with the two extremes. That's all. Well, of course, we can, through undermining one of the extremes, we flip to the other extreme, but we can then, through understanding that, we can slowly go a little bit away from those two extremes. That's possible. We can be holding, and there are many levels of the extreme of grasping, from very coarse to very subtle. So we can more easily let go of the coarse level of grasping, but then we're sort of a little bit closer to the middle way, but we're still grasping at a more subtle level. So yes, that can happen, that we're sort of flipping and slowly, slowly we're sort of coming to the centre. That's possible. Yeah.
Seems like a better term to use than master of mind. Master carries that weight of agency and authorship.
Yeah. But even witness, often when we use the word witness, then people grasp onto this witness. And who is this witness, you know? I'm observing the mind, but who's this witness? If that's the mind that I'm observing, who is this witness that is observing the mind? So whatever word we use, of course, we can grasp onto that. Of course. Right. Yes. Yeah, I'm recording this entire retreat, so I'm going to make the audio available to you all. I have to clean it up a little bit, then I'm going to upload it to Dropbox or Google Drive or something, and then probably, I think, Malay, is it? I'll send the link to Malay, and then he'll, I think he's got your email addresses, and he'll send it out to you, so then you can download that. So yes, for the meditations, that's exactly what we can do. As a beginner, if we're not familiar with the steps or the process, we can listen to these meditations a number of times until we become familiar with them, and then, of course, let it go and do it ourselves. Because if we keep listening to them, there's a very much danger it just becomes mechanical, and then we're not really doing the meditation and we become very lazy. But initially, then it's helpful, particularly these more analytical style meditations where there's a lot of steps like this Tonglen. You may need to follow that a number of times to become familiar. Whereas the mindfulness training, there's not really a lot of instruction. And so you probably don't need to listen to them too much to understand what to do. So yes, that's a good point. Yeah.
But the current world time you live in, would there be space to add a few more lines to that word in consultation with the larger how would it balance? So for instance, a good example would be humanity would be something gross human values, lost human values that have happened in the last 4 years. Basically because of violation of privacy and personal space. And other activists call for a transparent world where everyone knows about everything, which is good, but it won't work because the moment you introduce that into the system, it is power imbalance already. So people who are more powerful benefit from transparency more, or from economics more. So, essentially how, the end of this, you all go back home, talented scientists and artists might end up just creating trees and rainbows on the walls and you're actually creating something.
I mean,
but what should be I'm not saying you want to turn the state by
That's right. I mean, sometimes we hear the word socially engaged Buddhism. But then actually I find that a bit puzzling, because for me, if you understand Buddhism and you're not socially engaged at some level, then maybe you're not really following what the Buddha taught. But there's a couple of things here. One, of course, is, we see that over history there have been many injustices, and then there's been some sort of revolution. But unfortunately, the people who did the revolution were no more mentally advanced than the people who were perpetrating the crimes. So you get one dictator overthrowing another dictator. So we're not really making progress. So there's a very nice saying that says, if you want to change the world, change your mind. So therefore, we need this balance. We need a balance of transforming our mind, because unless we improve our own mind, whatever we do in the world is going to be limited benefit and maybe actually create harm because of our lack of own mental training. So we need a balance of that. We work on our own mind, plus a balance of interacting and working in the world in whatever capacity we have, depending on our skills and so forth. So we need that balance. If we don't have that balance, if we only develop our mind but we don't do anything in the world, then, as you suggested, the world stays a mess and maybe gets worse. Or if we don't develop ourselves and we only go out in the world to try to change it, then we just change one bad situation into another bad situation. So we need that balance. And that's, from our perspective, the best we can do, is if we really develop ourselves as best we can through these sorts of trainings, then, using our own particular talents, we then implement that in the world. We don't have to be a revolutionary or an activist or whatever. We could be doing it in a much different way, in a much more subtle way, having a positive impact in whatever area that we have. Because often people, you know, when they start to get into some sort of spiritual practice, and then at the same time they may have some sort of career, then often people get to this point where they have this dilemma. You know, should I do this career thing or should I do my spiritual thing? You know, which should I do? I think that's a wrong way of thinking. Because if we give up our career, particularly if it's our talent, and we do the spiritual thing, then, yes, we maybe develop ourselves, but how are we going to benefit the world if we've given up the one thing we're good at? We can't. So therefore, we need to integrate the two. We need to work and develop ourselves and then use whatever talents we have, in whatever way it is, to benefit the world. For example, I had a case like this, I think 2 years ago, when I was teaching in Dharamsala. Actually, it was an Indian man who was into marketing. And I don't think he was boasting, but he was saying he was very good at it. He was in a lot of demand in his marketing. But he didn't tell me what he was marketing, but I assume it was something not so meaningful. And so he had this dilemma. He didn't want to keep doing that. He wanted to be more spiritual. And he was thinking about giving it up. I said, no, don't give it up. You're obviously very good at it. Use this spiritual aspect, a more meaningful thing, and then market something more meaningful. You know, market like renewable energy or market something more meaningful to society. Then with your talent, you can have a very positive impact in that area. And so if we dedicate ourselves in whatever talents we have, rather than all going around waving flags and demanding justice, which for some people may be the best thing actually, but for many of us it may be to do something else that we're more talented in that we can bring more benefit. And if we all each did that, the collective effect would be enormous, rather than all jumping around shouting and criticising the government or criticising something, which of course has its place, but if that's all we ever did, you know, then nothing probably much is going to change.
I mean, at the deepest level, to really overcome that, we need to overcome this. Because we're grasping onto this me here, you know, I don't want to die. But that way of seeing ourselves as self-grasping is false, it's wrong. And if we can release that, then it said we can release fear of death altogether. As long as we have that false sense of self, we're going to have attachment, aversion, fear, anxiety, all sorts of things, particularly death. So if we're working particularly here at cognitive balance, but together with that emotional balance, in terms of self-cherishing, overcoming that and cherishing others, if we can work here at those two levels, particularly here, then we can really overcome the fear of death. In fact, often it's said that someone in a spiritual practice, within spiritual practice, who is an advanced level practitioner, often it's said that they delight at the thought of death. Because for them, death is simply a transition. And also, from a Buddhist perspective, the point of death is actually an excellent opportunity to achieve enlightenment. So for them, they delight at that thought. So they have no fear of death whatsoever. For them, it's just a transition, and it's a transition that offers an excellent opportunity to accelerate the spiritual path. So this is through this sort of training. Right. This substantiating the self, yeah.
And you said that 95% of the
people who are dressed as an object. Well, I don't know if I said 95%, but I'd say that the majority, what I said was that 95% of the modern day population is very discursive mind, And so therefore many of us, the breath could be the suitable object, but I don't think, yeah, anyway.
My question was, if I chose to continue using breath as an object,
sure, sure. Subtle level of what, sorry?
Right.
I see what you mean. No. I mean, both of those objects will end up in the same point. I mean, also when you are using the breath, the conceptual mind quietens down, the body quietens down, you can also get into this very spacious state of lack of grasping, so that's fine.
So I will not even notice my breathing.
Sure. Yes, exactly. In fact, they say at the higher levels of that practice, you adopt, because actually as we progress in that mindfulness training, due to the improved faculty of mindfulness, actually our sense faculties shut down. So you can't actually, at the higher levels, focus on the sensations here because your sense faculty is shut down. What happens though in that practice is spontaneously, instead of the sensations, a mental image appears related to the air element. It's called the acquired sign. And that can take many forms of like a light or a cobweb or a star, or it's something that spontaneously appears mentally. When that happens, you switch from the sensations to that mental object and you continue on that way. Acquired sign. It's called, that's the word. There's a particular Pali word to it, nimitta something or other, I can't remember exactly. Okay. Right. Right. So in general, it's best to stick with the same object and not keep swapping backwards and forwards. But if in a particular meditation session, let's say you're using the mind normally, but in a particular meditation session you're very agitated and tense and you can't relax, then you may shift back to full body awareness for a few minutes to relax and then go back to the mind. But if you just keep swapping backwards and forwards all the time, then yes, that's probably not so productive to do that. Yeah. Self-grasping. Is grasping to independent me. A person. Yeah. Self-cherishing. Is my happiness is more important. Of course, self-cherishing comes from self-grasping. If you don't have grasping on the independent me, you can't have self-cherishing. It's by definition impossible. So self-grasping is the basis for self-cherishing. Eternal happiness. What do you mean by the word eternal happiness? You mean it's some happiness that once you get it, you don't lose it? meaning once you get it, you never lose it. Genuine happiness, once we fully achieve it, then yes, it stays forever. Now we can strive for genuine happiness and we can have little taste of it, this inner peace and so forth. But genuine happiness really comes when we get rid of this. When we get rid of this, then we have genuine happiness because we're completely in harmony with reality. And so from a Buddhist perspective, that is the state of moksha, nirvana, liberation. That's when we have genuine happiness. Well, again, if you define eternal happiness in that way, that's synonymous. It would be synonymous. That at the point where you eliminate this ignorance, it can never come back again. So from that point on, there's no basis for any mental or emotional imbalance. Therefore, you are constantly 24/7 in this state of genuine happiness. If you want to call that eternal happiness, that's fine. Okay. Okay, one last short topic and then we'll take morning tea break. For all these practices, we need, of course, a conducive lifestyle. So in the text, it talks about sort of six things that are going to be very helpful as a support for these practices. And in the text, it's presented as the support for the intentional training. What we need as a support, a conducive lifestyle, but I think we can apply it to all of these four. So I'd just like to briefly list that now before we take a morning tea break. The meditation text. The meditation text that talk about this training, in that text it says if you want to do this in an effective way, you need what's called the six preconditions. Six things as a basis for doing this training. But I think we can apply it to all four. Well, of course, within Tibetan Buddhism, we follow the Tibetan Buddhist text, but then they refer back to the Indian texts, which refer back to the Buddha's scriptures. So, you know, you can go all the way back to the Buddha's sutras. Here in this preconditions, there's a quote from one text by Maitreya. Is actually the first point is quoting back there. A lot of these points coming from the Asanga, the great Indian master from the 4th century. But they're all, of course, then packaged up within Tibetan Buddhism that refer to all these various texts. The particular text in Tibetan Buddhism where this is mentioned is a lot, is a text coming from another great Indian master, Kamala Shila. The stages of meditation, it's called. I think the second stages of meditation from Kamala Shila talks a lot about these points. I think he was about the 8th century. So the first is that we need a supportive environment. And this can talk about the physical environment, you know, particularly for this sort of training, to have something quiet and so forth. But in this supportive environment, also what is mentioned is to have support from other people. And this brings in the idea within Buddhism that is very much emphasized, this idea of sangha. Meaning spiritual community. The reality is if we try to do this training on our own, many of us will find it almost impossible. Because now we have so much imbalances, these are interfering and causing problems, and we're not really even going to be able to begin this. We're going to continue to get caught up in our old habits. I know from personal experience. When I first came into Buddhism many years ago, did some training, full of enthusiasm, wanted to go home and transform my life. For 2 years, nothing happened.
Absolutely nothing. I didn't even meditate, even though I wanted to. Because of this. Particularly this. I just got swept up in my old habits. And so I didn't go anywhere. It was only when I found some sangha, some spiritual community that helped support me, that I began to start to do something. So I think for many of us, this is critical. In fact, probably for all of us, it's critical. If we don't have sangha, spiritual community support as a beginner, I think many of us will find any of this training almost impossible. We're just going to get caught up in our old habits. We're not going to have any time to meditate, all sorts of things. So this is the first point, supportive environment. And I can't overemphasize the importance of this. Then the next two relate a little bit to this. And the next two is having few desires and being content. Here, of course, we're talking about material desires, money, wealth, possessions. So if we're caught up, and that's why motivational balance is so important, because if we're caught up in craving a lot of money and wealth and possessions, then we're not going to have any basis for any of this training. So few desires is in terms of the things that we don't have, and being content is with respect to the things we do have. And again, this is not talking about material wealth and possessions. The next point is few activities, meaning to simplify our life. Again, the reality is most of us have busy, hectic, fast-paced lives. And of course, some of the things that we engage our time in is necessary. Probably most of us need to work at some level to support ourselves, and there may be some family responsibilities and a few other things that are important. But actually, we tend to fill up the rest of our day with lots of other stuff for a couple of reasons. One reason often is, in our modern society, it's often said that if we're not doing something, we're not being productive. So we need to do something, anything, just do something. And of course, also, if we're not doing anything, we're sitting there quietly, it forces us to look at our mind. We don't like that because it's a mess. So we distract ourselves, we busy ourselves, so we don't actually have to look at our own mind. It's such a mess. So here, we need to simplify our life, because if we don't, we're not going to have any time to meditate and to devote to any of these sorts of practices. Here, rather than forcibly cutting things out of our life, which is always going to be a struggle, what is much more recommended, certainly from the Buddhist perspective, is two particular reflections, part of what's called preliminary practices. And that is to reflect on our precious human life, the fact that we've got this human life full of opportunities, and death. Because if we can reflect on these two things, and really reflect on, we've got this precious opportunity and it's not going to last forever, we want to take advantage of it. Because now, like many things in our life, we take things for granted. We only generally appreciate things when we've lost them or about to lose them. And that's what happens with our life. We don't appreciate our life and how wonderful opportunities we have. It's only later in life, as we're approaching death, we realise, oh, I've wasted my life, and we're full of regrets, full of regrets. So in Buddhism, as some of the preliminary practices to a lot of this stuff, these two reflections are very much emphasized. To really reflect on our precious human life, how wonderful opportunities we have, and the fact of death, that it's not going to last forever. We don't know how long we're going to live. If we reflect on these two things, we'll see what a precious opportunity we have. We're not going to want to waste it. And then when we look at all of these activities that don't really bring us anything, we're going to simply lose interest in them. We're not going to want to spend any time with them. This is very much highlighted in people who have had near-death experiences. Often people with near-death experiences, they have directly seen death. They really appreciate the preciousness of life.
their lives are often transformed. And often you see they just don't want to spend one moment of their time in any meaningless activity because it's completely useless. So they never waste their time on meaningless activities. We don't need to have a near-death experience to have that attitude. We can simply reflect on our precious human life and death. And on that point, I'd like to read a little quote here from someone who I think all of you know quite well, Steve Jobs. Used to be the CEO of Apple. And this was a speech he gave at Stanford University, I think 10 or 15 years ago, to the students there. And he said the following. He's got just two paragraphs. He said, "When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, 'If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right.' It made an impression on me, and since then, for the past 33 years, I have looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, 'If today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I'm about to do today?' And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart." So I think that's some good advice from Steve Jobs. Then two more points and then we'll take a break. The fifth one is ethical lifestyle. And I think this is the basis of any sort of meaningful life, that if we don't have the basis of ethics, then we can't really have a meaningful life. And then the last point is eliminating compulsive thoughts. We talked about this briefly at the beginning. We're all suffering OCD, obsessive compulsive delusional disorder. We all tend to obsess about certain things. As long as we're obsessing about certain things, and it's often about things out there that's based on this motivational imbalance, as long as we're caught up in a lot of this obsessive compulsive thinking, we're not going to have a basis for this training. So if we notice any sort of obsessive compulsive thinking, really try to reduce that as much as possible. And then, of course, within things like attentional training, we can work on that even more and reduce it much, much more. So these are mentioned as the prerequisites or preconditions for attention training in the text, but I think we can apply that to all of these trainings. Okay. So let's take a morning tea break and come back at 11 o'clock and then give some more daily life practical advice before we wrap up and finish this morning at 12 o'clock. But first, let's take a morning tea break.